probably aware, we are recording these arguments, and the arguments are made available on our website. For the benefit of those who might be listening later, as you approach the lectern, and this goes to all counsel who are present, as you approach the lectern, I'd appreciate it if you'd enter an appearance and simply state your name and the party you represent so that the tape can identify. On that, we'll proceed with the first case, docket number 2007-3143, Urio versus OPM. Mr. Gates.
Good afternoon. John Gates for the petitioner, Ms. Maria Uriel. The essential facts of this case are not in dispute, just to briefly cover those. Ms. Uriel's husband, Ricardo, had served in the Navy for 12 years, resigned that position to take a job with the Department of Defense. 4 months and 25 days into that job, he died, leaving Ms. Uriel as his surviving widow.
How do you distinguish Brown?
Brown, I believe, addresses, well, first of all, the petitioner in Brown was seeking a lump sum payment, lump sum.
Well, we're dealing with the same language.
Yes, it's the same statute, but my position is that there's three parts to that statute. There's sort of an introductory part, then there's A and B, A going to the lump sum, and B talking about the annuity. And I don't believe, and I know OPM's position is, that you can't read B in a complete vacuum. You have to attach it to that OPM paragraph. But I think if you do that, the results, it can become very illogical, as I pointed out in the last paragraph of my brief.
But A and B are both subsections of the introductory clause that specifies 18 months of civilian service. And on what basis do you contend that that 18 months of civilian service only applies to A and not B?
Because I think if the intent was to eliminate any confusion and have the first paragraph apply both to A and B, there would have been some sort of qualifying or explanatory language in B, such as, you know, if something to the effect that if an employee or member completed at least 10 years of service, of which 18 months must be of civilian service. The reason I think there's a distinction is because I think everyone all along has confused these statutes. If I may, even OPM in the early going of this case had some trouble. In the initial agency decision, which is in the appendix of page 5, they say, the OPM says, you are not eligible, talking to Ms. Uriel, you are not eligible for an annuity because your spouse did not complete a minimum of 18 months credible service. Well, that's not the case. There's confusion. It's not 18 months of credible service. He qualifies for credible service. Again,
well, that's your theory that the preamble language of B1 only applies to subsection capital A. Subsection capital B.
That's my position.
So if we reject that and we read the preamble as applying to subsection capital B, you lose, right?
I'm sorry.
If we read the preamble language of B1 as applicable to capital subsection B, you lose, right?
No. If you apply the introductory B1 to B, then I would.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about subsection A.
No.
Okay. Again, in the reconsideration decision, which is in the pages 6 and 7 of the appendix, OPM says, since Mr. Uriel had less than 10 years of service, you are not eligible for the survivor annuity. And again, confusion over that, just how this is interpreted. And I think their confusion reigns in that. Who knows how long this confusion reigns because of the way the statute is written. And as I said before, the way you can look at this and extend it to its logical or illogical absurdity is the example I give. If Mr. Uriel had served, rather than 12 years in the Navy, had served 19 years, then had gone to work for the Department of Defense. He worked there for 17 months and then died. According to this, he would not be eligible for an annuity, despite the fact that he had over 20 years of credible service with the United States government. So it just doesn't make sense that you would apply subsection or subpart B to that B1 prefatory language. It just doesn't make sense when you apply it in that way. And Brown, again, Brown goes to lump sum, and the language in Brown, I think this is what OPM had cited in their brief, had talked about not using military service in calculating these 18 months, but it goes back to B1. In that Brown opinion, the judge in that case directs that her language or his language to B1 and doesn't address that whole statute. In other words, doesn't talk about B. I don't think there's anything that really sets out and says that B and A, A and B are linked to B1.
But isn't that the normal way you would read a statute like this? B1 ends with the phrase entitled to dash, and then you have subsection capital A, which ends with the word and subsection B. It seems to me that those are two alternatives that follow under B1, and you say it doesn't make sense to read it any other way, but to me, the only logical and reasonable way to read this is to read both capital A and capital B to fall under.
Well, I understand. That's if I were on the other side, I'd be making that argument. But you can also look at that if you're looking at the grammatical construction of that. That first part starts with the letter with the word if, and then subsection B starts with the letter if, with the word if. And so it's almost as though they're separating the two right there. If an employee, et cetera, and then down there, if an employee member completed at least 2 years. I think you can very easily look at that.
There are two conditions.
B1
is one condition, you know, if you have 18 months civilian service, and if you have 10 years of military service.
Two if phrases. But that's what I said earlier. I think if the legislature truly wanted to apply B to B1, there would have been some language in subsection B that made it clear that of the 10 years, you must have 18 months of that 10 years must be submitted. That's my opinion. If there are no other questions, I'll do it.
Matthew Solomonson for the respondent, OPM. May it please the court should affirm the MSPB's decision below denying petitioner's claim for a survivor annuity benefit. I'll just briefly address the two points argued by petitioner. The first point petitioner argued regarding Brown, petitioner contends that case only dealt with a lump sum benefit, and the government argues, and it is the case, that case dealt with both a lump sum and an annuity benefit, as can be seen from the MSPB decision below in that case, where at the very beginning the MSPB specifically notes that appellant Brown sought both a lump sum payment of $15,000 and one half of her husband's annual rate of pay. Goes on to tell you what the amount of the annuity would be. On appeal, the Federal Circuit doesn't directly call out that there's a distinction between the lump sum and the annuity payment, but does say that while credible military service counts toward computation of survivor annuity, that does not mean that the military service establishes eligibility for benefits in the first place, referring to benefits generically, and again, not dealing just with a lump sum payment as petitioner suggests.
But both of the payments sought by Ms. Brown fell under subsection capital A, correct?
No, Your Honor, I disagree. I think that it's not...
50% of the final annual rate and the lump sum.
Correct.
That's subsection A. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I understood the case.
Okay, I understood it as a B1B, where B1B refers to an annuity equal to 50% of an annuity computed under Section 8415. But I understand what Your Honor is saying. In either event, though, it seems clear to me that that B1B cannot be divorced from that introductory language. I think the clearest indication that that's the case is the fact that the verb is entitled to is in the preamble language of B1, such that if you were just to read B1B alone, as the petitioner contends, there would be no instruction to the agency about what to do. There's simply no verb in B1B that would tell you even who is entitled to what. So, in fact, B1B can't even be read without that preamble language. I would also note briefly that the decision of this court, Brown, is consistent with this court's decision in Tirado, also in the same sort of structure, noting that civilian service is necessary to obtain the same sort of annuity under the older civil service retirement plan. And to that extent, petitioner's position here would actually read the word civilian service sort of out of this section of B1. If the court has no further questions, Dr. Rest on its brief.
Thank you. Mr. Gates,
just one other point. In Brown, the language that we quote from that decision, the court says the decedent's years of military service performed between 1950 and 1952, while allowable under 5 U.S.C. Section 8411 as credible federal service toward a future retirement annuity or a survivor annuity, cannot be considered as the necessary civilian service that is required by 5 U.S.C. Section 8442 B1. And that was what I referred to earlier. It goes back to, it doesn't clearly say, I'm sorry, 8442 B1, before a widow is entitled to lump sum death benefit. I think they make it very clear in Brown that that decision and everything that's going on there applies only to the lump sum death benefits under that section of B1 at the A.
Your argument isn't that the court has somehow excluded B, or rather they didn't address it. That opinion focused on the case in front of them, which involved only B1A.
I think correct? So. I agree. I think they weren't going to deal with it at all. Because with that language, entitled to lump sum benefits at the very end, I think they're just ignoring B in their opinion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.